Hello and welcome again to the Wide World of Wargaming Age of Sigmar podcast. As always, I am your host, Alex, and I have today with me Garrett and John. Our co-hosts Matthew and Jeremy are out today. We do miss them, but you'll see them again in future episodes. John, what is on your workbench?
Hey, how's it going there, Alex? Well, on my workbench here, I just have a few things I'm touching up. We have the end of our Escalation League over at the Game Castle Mountain View. Tomorrow is my 2,000-point game for for third place. And so I have a unit that I'm going to enter in the painting contest. So I'm going to been doing a little touch-up on that. Other than that, I'm enjoying a fine Binde Sergarde. Established in 1349, a Chianti Classico. So I have a nice little Chianti that my boss gave me the other week, and that's quite enjoyable. Just relaxing. As you know, I ran the Game Castle Open over the weekend, and 2 days of running a 40-person 40K GT has me a little on the tired side here. So I'm definitely looking forward to rolling some Age of Sigmar dice this week and getting back into the groove of things. Garrett, how are you doing this week, my friend?
I just want to say it's weird hearing 40 as a large event these days, because like everywhere I look, I feel like 40K is hitting like 64 is like the minimum for running events these days. It's so crazy how big 40K is getting.
It really is. And I probably would have had a lot more players, but as you know, there was a huge tournament in Bakersfield, so that pulled most of the Southern California crowd. Okay. So I had 40 players, all from the Bay Area.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually just got back from a tournament this weekend. I was up in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, up at the Basement Wargamers Summer Slaughter. It was a combination Age of Sigmar 40K. They were able to hit that 64 number while we had a comfortable 26. So it was a really, really cool event. I came back from that, and I'm on the tournament high, getting right back into the game, preparing for Wargames Con. So I learned at that event that I need to practice. I have not been playing as much as I need to, so I'm planning on playing 2 to 3 times a week. I've got a new list I'm going with. List submission deadlines are approaching fast for Wargames Con, so I got to get a lot of practice in to make sure I can dial down exactly what I'm going to be taking. So I got to jump in and paint some new stuff to get the new list going. And so I played a game yesterday versus a guy from out here, Lincoln. And then I got a game going tomorrow morning scheduled up, and I got another game lined up Thursday or Friday. So I'll get 3 games in this week, and then I got to just continue going on with that next week. And then it's Wargames Con. Or no, the week after it'll be Wargames Con. So yeah, I got a lot going for. Other than that, I'm treating myself to a root beer float this evening. So,
ooh, tasty.
Yeah, grab some vanilla ice cream and these, what is it? Appalachian root beer, craft brewed Appalachian root beer. It's quite tasty. It's a honey root beer, so it's got a nice little honey sweetness to it. I always like those honey sweetened root beers. So, Alex, how are you doing this evening?
Oh man, I could, I'm just getting things done. Kind of a busy guy. I did have a tournament I went to this weekend, the Forge of Souls in Spokane, Washington. Both Matthew and Jeremy were at that event, and there were some, we all came back with awards, so that was very fun. However, that is something that we're going to want to review in a in our next episode, as I got best sports, but Jeremy got best general, and Matthew got best overall. So, it was definitely a really fun event, and Gamers Haven in Spokane is a very accommodating venue. You know, they have the Harvester of Souls and the Storm of Silence 40K events in both the fall and the spring. And then in the summer and winter, they have the Forge of Souls for AOS, as well as the Hammer for AOS GTs. That being said, I do also have an iced coffee that I'm drinking tonight. I just got got a lot of stuff to do, so gotta stay up. And we, right now I'm just trying to get some last minute things together to go up to Seattle to, send off a friend of the community, as well as, trying to go to T-Shift this weekend as well. So, that being said, there are a few things we do want to look into today. We want to take a look at the changes or in potential avenues and outlets that we can have with the Forbidden Power spells, as well as some of the additional features that did come out in that book. Now, it has come out. It has been out for several weeks, but we want to talk a little bit in this episode today, regarding the competitive use of some of these spells and items. Before we do so, though, Garrett, you did tell us just a little bit earlier about that event that you went to, this Basement Wargamers event. Can you tell me a little bit more about that before we move on?
Yeah, so met the Basement Wargamer guys at the Triumph GT, and actually they were one of the groups that last season us and our team were kind of seeing a lot. They played a lot of events and they were doing well in the ITC, so I was actually really excited to meet these guys. Turns out they're a wonderful group of guys, a group of just drinking buddies up in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, and they put on this really great event in Gamers Heaven in store. I thought it was called Gamers Haven, but then when we got there and saw the sign, my friend James was like, "Garrett, it's called Gamers Heaven." And I was like, "Oh, okay, so it's not the same store." So
you know, I'm real disappointed to hear everything you've said so far. After our little sort of distant rivalry with these guys last year, I was really hoping you'd tell me that they were a bunch of whack jerks, and to find out that they're a bunch of cool people is very disappointing.
Yeah, way to take the air out of our balloon.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of really weird. Like James and I were saying, the store itself was like a nice, normal. It was a large store. They had a 64-person 40K event with a 26-person AOS, and they had plenty of space. Big, really great store. Bring BYOB, because selling alcohol in Pennsylvania is a little weird. So, but they allow you to just bring in your own beer and alcohol and drink in the store.
East Coast states.
Yeah, right. Us and our blue laws out here. But it's a really cool store. But honestly, like the guys that put on the show, the Basement Wargamers, they just made – it was so much fun going out there. They – like we got there at 8 a.m. and they handed James a beer and a shot of scotch. And then I think by 10 a.m. James was like six drinks in and ready to start playing in the tournament. And like they were just – they handed out swag bags with like shot glasses and beer cozies and tactical gauges, and they just – it was a lot of fun, super great group of guys putting on music and just overall really positive energy. It was overall very, very fun event. Really want to go again next year. We're definitely going to spend more time up there because Phoenixville actually is like really cool. We drove through the downtown our way to the hotel and it was like really hopping, like nice, cool, like bars and pubs and live music going on. So apparently they have a lot of summer festivals. So yeah, definitely next year we're going to try to go for a little longer and have a good time. As far as the playing in the event, I played in four games. I didn't play the fifth game because James and I decided that we wanted to get home to our families, and we kind of squeezed this event in anyways. And so if we weren't going to do well in the event, we were just going to drop out and go home early. So James played his last game and I played my last game, and then we decided to pack up and go, said our goodbyes. But I had four really good games. My first game was against Matt Obringer. I think he ended up in fourth in the event with Skaven. I ended up getting a minor loss against him. It was an incredibly close game on escalation. He pushed up fairly aggressively, not realizing you don't get to score turn one. So I was able to capitalize on that, take the objectives and punish him a bit for that. And then I got the double turn to overly punish him, score a bunch of points, or I actually only got 1 point that first turn. And then I got all 3 points on the third turn. But then he was able to push back, actually steal one objective, get 2 points. And so we were tied 4-4. It came down just to the wire. We only played three turns because we had 250 models on the field for most of the game. We deployed our whole armies. So it was a long game. but we both had a really good time. We both used up about the same amount of time. I don't think either of us slow played each other. Just took a long time to roll all those dice, move all those models, and really close game. I was very happy with a minor loss, honestly, because I went into that game expecting to not do well. The Storm Vermin Skaven list is quite a hard list to fight in general, and so I was really nervous going in. My next game was against this wonderful good dude, Grant Lawrence, and he was super fun, super energetic, and he completely obliterated me with dice rolls. It was just awful. Like, he came in with Gut Rot and 10 Blight Kings and made a 15-inch charge. Because he had cogs were up, and he had plus one to charge and run and charge rolls from his banner. So he rolled boxcars on his charge roll, stole my back objective in Border War, and then double turned me, kept the back objective, basically tabled my army. And it's like, it was one of those games where Manfred would throw all of his attacks into his general, you know, a 7-wound general with a 4-up save. Manfred has 4 attacks at 2s and 2s, rend 1, d3 damage. 2 attacks at 3s and 3s, rend 1, d2 damage. 6 attacks at 4s and 3s, rend 2, 2 damage. And 6 attacks on 6s causing mortal wounds. And I did 5 damage.
Whoa.
Yeah, he was rolling really hot on his saves, and it was just like every time he'd roll, it'd be like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, he uses Rodigus's spell, gets it off, which no one ever does, and then he rolls 6 out of 7 4 ups to target 6 you of my units.
This is normal.
Yeah, like, so I mean, I'd made some mistakes on that game. I don't want to, you know, take away his win. He definitely deserved the win, but the dice were the dice were definitely against me. We both saw that. I rolled about average. I didn't roll poorly, but it was just, he was rolling hot. I didn't get the rolls I needed. And like, he'd rolled 9 at all of his casting, and I'd roll 8 at all my denies. It's just one of those games. My list crumbled. We played to turn 5, and he did not table me. So I'm happy about that.
That's pretty good. And for the record, just because somebody beats you by 1 on every dice roll, that doesn't make it a close game.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So my third game was against a Fire Slayer player, although he was very tired. He was one of the club members, and he was up until 2 a.m. building and painting terrain. And then he wakes up at 8 a.m. to come to the event and help set up. So I think he was feeling a little sick and he was a little tired. And so he brought out a Fire Slayer's army. It was an interesting Fire Slayer's list, similar to Jeremy's, but I think more Volkite Berserkers than Jeremy would field. And, I think he was just making a couple mistakes. Like, he took first turn against me and then ran up to the middle of the field, but didn't really take any of the objectives, which allowed me to just kind of move up, tie up his 30-man Hearthguard Berserker unit, cap all the objectives, and then just control the battlefield. And so then I just sat there and I just used Manfred's spell slinging, and I just sniped out all of his heroes. And so then it was 3 places of power. So I just sat on the objectives. I got way ahead of him, sniped out all of his heroes, and then we called it. So I was ending the day 1-2, you know, definitely in need of some practice, I realized by the end of the day. So I was willing to go into the next day. James was 2-1, and we decided that if he could go 4-1, it would be worth staying. But we'll see. So we decided to stay for the next day. My fourth game was against Fire Slayers again. It was an interesting Fire Slayers list because he had no run and charge capabilities as his entire army. So I made him go first, or no, he made me go first, but then I just kind of casually moved up the field, and it's like, well, you're not really going to be able to charge me, even with your, I think he could have charged one of my units, but I was going to be okay with that because he was going to use Volkite Berserkers. I was in my territory, and I had 40 skeletons that would just get, you know, in my table after +1 save. And it's like, honestly, I don't care if they die because I had 30 Graveguard that can counter charge afterwards. And so without having that run and charge capability with the Hearthguard Berserkers, I was able to win that list just because we played the whole game in his deployment zone, and it was total commitment. And so I eventually stole one of his objectives, got a point ahead, and he never came back to steal mine. And so we called it because there was no way he could get ahead. And that was the end of the game there. So yeah, that was my last game. And then I just watched James finish his last game, and then we packed up and went home.
Mm-hmm. Wow, sounds like a lot of fun, man. That's a tasty tournament with some great games in there.
Yeah, I definitely need practice though. My first game, I made a bunch of mistakes that I shouldn't have made. That I possibly could have pulled out a really close win, or could have kept the minor loss still. But either way, I just switched to Legion of Knight from my Khorne army, and I'd only played like two games going into this tournament, and I regretted it instantly. So,
You think you would have done better if you had stuck with your Khorne army because you're more familiar with it?
No, I don't think I would have done better with my Khorne army. I hadn't played my Legion of Knight in a while, and the game has changed a bit since I had. And so I wasn't doing as well as I had like at LVO or something. I just wasn't on top of my game because the two armies do play very differently. And so the way I played was not the way a Legion of Knight army should be played.
Oh, there you have it, folks, from the former champion of the ITC. Practice makes perfect.
Oh, yeah, certainly. It definitely does. And if I can ask, you know, bringing Legion of Knight, that is something you have traditionally done in the past. I know you're a Manfred fanboy. Ugh. But
wow. Well, how do you really feel, Alex? I mean,
oh, no, that's not how he really feels. I've heard worse.
You know, what does your Legion of Knight army list look like right now? I don't think, you know, you have been on that Khorne train for a while, and you know, after that one GT, I know that it was probably time to move on. But let's get the details. How'd it look like?
So my list at the event, which after this event I have now changed it, but I had Manfred, my boy. Ugh. Then I had a Necromancer and an Arc Regent as an ally. Then I had two units of 40 skeletons, one unit of swords, one unit of spears, a unit of 5 dogs, and a unit of 30 Grave Guard, the Geminids, Cogs, and Baleman Vortex. And then my relic was Morbidex Claw on the Necromancer.
So this is your LVO list?
My LVO list had Morghasts in it. I dropped the Morghasts for Graveguard, basically, and added more skeletons. And I dropped the Grimghast Reapers. I dropped the Grimghast Reapers and the Morghasts, and I added 40 skeletons in Graveguard and the Geminids. And I lost a Vampire Lord for the
Arbor. So a lot more bodies.
Yes, a lot more bodies, which I am definitely seeing the benefit of a lot more bodies. So I like the list a lot more.
What's your model count on that one?
110 skeletons, 5 dogs, 118 models.
Oh, okay, not bad, not bad.
It was 157 wounds, I think, was the total.
It would be weird only moving 120 models, but it might be okay.
Yeah, so my new list for Wargames Con, mainly because they're not using realm spells, I have dropped Manfred, because I think without realm spells, the main benefits you get of him really go away. So I'm running now Death March. So I dropped the dogs and Manfred, and I have two units of 40 skeletons, a unit of 10 skeletons, a White King on a horse, Necromancer, Arc Regent, a unit of 20 Grave Guard, unit of 10 Black Knights, the Geminids, Balewind, Death March, and I have a Karn Wraith, and I'm 30 points down trying to get a Triumph.
Why do you have a Karn Wraith?
So I needed a cheap hero. Basically, I had 80 points to spend, and I wanted to be – I had 90 points to spend, and I wanted to be 30 points down because the new Triumphs are really, really good, especially in my army.
No, right.
So I went with the Karn Wraith because he's only 60 points. And what I'll use him for is to be a hero that I outflank with the Grave Guard so that I can use reroll charge command abilities with him. And I can give death saves to my Grave Guard now. I can use reroll ones to hit command abilities. Basically, he could just be a command. He's a command ability engine for the Grave Guard and a support unit with them. And he's also not an awful hero. He's just cheap.
I'm not a big fan, but okay. You know, different strokes for different folks. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, you do bring up.
I'm basically spending I'm basically spending 60 points to give Graveguard or pass out death saves and do more command abilities and have another hero for hero based objectives.
Okay. So, you know, you bring up another good point here. You mentioned that this WarGamesCon that you are preparing for doesn't have realm spells. And, you know, my GT that we'll talk about next week, the one that Jeremy and Matthew had come and participated in as well, that also didn't have realm spells. But it was mainly because the tournament organizer, you know, I'd asked him. He said he just honestly wasn't familiar with them, simply because it had been a while since he had ran, since he had played the game. So I couldn't really knock him for that. But, you know.
Or was he afraid of, like taking the risk and maybe putting up a broken situation or something like that? Or didn't trust the players to balance it out?
A little of everything. I mean, you know, we can get into this next week. Okay. But, you know, my final matchup with Jeremy, I got a minor loss against him. And it was an incredibly good game. And it was an incredibly close game. But, you know, it was a Realm of Fire without realm spells against Fire Slayers, who did have the run and charge mechanic, so they were put to, they were put together properly and effectively. And then they it was Realm of Fire without the realm spell, so I didn't have the ability to utilize things like an extra reroll one save spell, or you know, or the plus one to hit and charge spell, or Inferno Blades plus one damage spell. So I had a lot less. I didn't have the ability to take a hit from him, and I didn't have the ability to really effectively give out damage to him, unless I was very strategic and very surgical. And you know, Pure Night Hunt has to play KHP, or else they're just not going to do well. So you got to be very smart when you play them, and when you do, and you play them well, they're very good. But you got to play them very smart. And you know, it was Scorched Earth on the Realm of Fire without realm spells, but with realm a realmscape, and that realmscape was every league a mile, or every step a league. And that's the one where if you have the fly keyword and you move over 6 inches on a 4+, your unit takes a mortal wound. On a 6+, they take D3 mortal wounds. Oh, and that hurts my army. So, yeah, so that wasn't fun.
Yeah.
But it was like if you make a move or a charge at that distance, or if you make a move over 6 or a charge over 10. And Nighthaunt needs a charge over 10 to get Wave of Terror off, an unmodified 10. So, you know, it just like, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's like the worst. And every time you see a Realm of Fire mission in a tournament, I'm always like, I just like, for me, it's better for my heart to just know that the Realmscape is going to be that one, so that I'm not like, so that my soul isn't crushed every time I get to the table. So every time I see Realm of Fire, I'm like, okay, it's that one.
So at the Summer Slaughter, the interesting thing they did is for missions, they had 7 missions set up with one of each realm assigned to each mission. And then they randomly determined 5 of them for the tournament. And the Realmscape feature they used was no Realmscape feature. Every mission had no Realmscape feature.
Huh. That's reasonable. And they, but still use the realm spells and realm command abilities.
Yep, all the other realm rules were in play. They just basically had every realm choose the number one option, which is no effect. Like every realm has the number one on their random feature is no effect. So they just had that for all of them.
Okay.
That's interesting. That might be a little more balanced approach too, because then again, you're giving the spells and command abilities to everybody, but some of those realm features are harsh to particular armies.
Yeah, and they in the Realm of Beasts, they did have a keyword. There's a don't add an extra monster. So they said, ignore that thing. Just use the rest of the Realm
yeah,
of Beasts.
Yeah, and that's what... Right. Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, it's... Oh, I was going to say, it's just despite all our discussion when these realms first came out about how we might handle Realm of Beasts and different ways to do it, I have personally yet to either use Realm of Beasts or attend a tournament that used the Realm of Beasts.
I think LVO round 6 was in the Realm of Beasts, which you didn't play in because you weren't top 8.
Fair enough.
But just you did play.
Just
yeah.
Take that dig. yeah, okay.
I didn't either, so, you know.
Oh, fair.
Yeah.
but I just, you did play in an event that did use Realm of Beasts. You just didn't notice.
Okay. Okay. Catch me on the tech, Kelly. You're always, if nothing else, my foil.
Yeah. You know, something when we talk about the idea of realm spells too, and like the policies that a TO should make, I don't mind the idea or the policies that are done at, the, I want to say it's the London GT, the, where you can have one, you know, you have the table, you have the realm, or you have the mission, you have the realmscape, you have the realm, and you have two spells, you know, and the command ability, or maybe three spells, but you don't have all six or seven spells.
Yeah, I like that better. I think I did that for the Winter War, where we only took one, I forget if it was one or two, but I think it was only one spell. And I think that just by limiting the set, whether you want to go with, we're just going to allow this one or two, or you say, these two or three are banned. You have to control it.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, you know, your tournament packet was really great, John. And yours actually wasn't two. It was one. It was one.
Yeah, it's been so many months. I bet, you know, we're actually closer to the next Winter War, which is only 4 months away, than the last one, which is
John.
Now,
my apologies. I was talking about Bay Area Open, not Winter Wars.
Yeah, the packet you were talking about, John, was BAU.
Oh, you're right. It was. Man, you know what? I tell you what, guys, I am super tired from this weekend, and I might just make crazy stuff up for the rest of the podcast. Who knows?
Well, you know, it sounds like we've all had a real interesting time recently. You know, going into the thick of things, you know, we did want to talk about some of the new abilities from Forbidden Power. Now, you know, for our listeners, Forbidden Power is not new. It came out right before the General's Handbook 2019. But, you know, we have had a few weeks or a couple, you know, about a month to really mull over a lot of the spells and the, you know, the Penumbral Engine. And we wanted to talk today and see what we can do to have a discussion about some of the combos and the effective use of these spells and terrain feature. You know, I do want to start off with one that is going to be the least interesting, because it's just good to start off with something we can skip over real quick. And, you know, there were, and this is all available in the Forbidden Power book, but, you know, there were the six endless spells, five endless spells, and then the engine itself. The engine is a terrain piece. It's worth 100 points. It is a funky looking, I forgot the name of the device, like the start of Game of Thrones, all the rings and loops. Yeah, it looks like kind of like that. And it's a funky looking device. It's actually kind of big. I would say it's probably 120, 140 mil circle, basically. And it's probably about 4 inches tall. So it's a pretty big model. And it is a piece of terrain. You spend 100 points on it. It has a few things that are useful, but all in all, I want to read off the rules. And Garrett, John, if you guys think that there might be some good combination here, let me know. I have not yet fought against this, but nor do I personally expect to. But you know, it has a few things. Where at the start of the first battle round, you roll a d6 and you see what your table is. And at the start of and there's on a 1 through 3. You can reroll save rolls of 1 for attacks that target units wholly within 12 of the engine, of this terrain feature. If you roll 4 through 6, at the start of your hero phase, you receive 1 extra command point if any of your friendly heroes are within 12 inches of this terrain feature. So one of the abilities is really great. One of them is situational at best. You know, the one extra rule this thing has is that at the start of each battle round after the first, you roll a dice, and on 1 through 4, nothing happens. But on a 5 to 6, you re-roll this ability. Now, I personally am not really that excited about this thing. I mean, being able to have either re-roll ones near an objective, or, you know, basically having a commanding terrain feature without having the commanding terrain feature or requiring your general to be by it, that is pretty useful, but that is a 100-point investment.
Yeah, the 100-point investment is really rough, because you have, I mean, if you can get the 4+ to get extra command points, then in two turns, if you don't roll a 5+ to make it flip, you can get your investment back in command points. But I feel like if you're trying to get, like, if you really are that command point starved, since you can only buy one command point now, then maybe. But it's still just, because the reroll ones on saves is neat, but like that's just Mystic Shield. Like I don't know many, like maybe a Nighthaunt army who reroll ones on saves is actually incredibly powerful. But otherwise, I don't know a lot of things where reroll ones on saves are actually useful. Like Stormcast, they get it so easily. Khorne, Mortals, maybe.
And then everything else has such bad saves that who cares, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's
that's
like,
what I always look at. It's like, I can get reroll ones to save on my 6+ saves. Yay.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like the 1-3 is so just meaningless and not worth 100 points to most armies. You're basically begging for a 4+ and hoping to God that you never roll a 5+ to make it flip. So it's just, I guess I could see maybe a Nighthaunt army where you got a bunch of dudes in the back that have unrendable saves. The reroll ones is super powerful. And then the command points, if you have, if you're able to balance the use of the command points, but you're okay if you get the reroll saves, then maybe worth 100 points.
Boy, that's a slim maybe. I mean,
yeah,
like maybe you find a 100-point character that does that for you too. I personally have never seen this on the table. I think it's kind of a gimme for people, for armies that have no terrain associated with them. Personally, the way I look at this is I think that it's been presented wrong. Rather than being a 100-point piece of terrain, it should be more like, here's a piece of terrain that's free, like all the other terrains. And if you want, you can take this instead of your faction terrain. Or if you have no faction terrain, you take this as your faction terrain. And then, boom. So it's nothing great, but it's on the line of a free terrain piece. So yeah. That would be my thought on it.
Yeah, that's how I thought it was going to be when it was first announced. We're all like, oh, because when it was first announced, we're like, and everybody's getting a faction terrain, and it's going to be a generic one. And then we saw it, and it's like, oh, that's 100 points? Never mind. Yeah. Like, it would be a nice free piece, yeah, because, I mean, it does affect anybody. So if your opponent gets a hero within 12 inches, they also get command points. Because it's you, even though you buy it, it still affects everyone, because scenery is scenery. No one owns scenery. So,
yeah, it's rough. I understand that. I personally, I mean, you guys talk about it, you know, you talk about how it's useful with a Nighthaunt army. You will never see me run this in a tournament play. I don't see the helpfulness there, at least not in my army, not in my particular list. However, you know, for some people, they might find it useful. Yeah, I just wanted to get that one out of the way, as this seems to be the least likely and effective of the group. Moving on to, you know, the spells. You know, a lot of these endless spells have some funky things, but actually, before we jump in there, Garrett, do you have any more thoughts you might want to share?
I was going to say, like, I know we were going to talk about match play, but in a narrative play, I could see this be fun to just plop in the middle of the table as a just part of the, and use its war scroll, have it in the middle, and it kind of now affects both armies, and you're randomly rolling to see what happens. I could see it actually still being a very fun piece of terrain, just it's not a very competitive piece of terrain.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right. That's a good description here for our listeners. Yeah. Taking a look now at the spells, you know, there are a lot of them, and some of them at face value were kind of, oh, my apologies, were really, really crazy when Forbidden Power first came out. Some of them have now seen changes where you might not ever see them. However, we're going to start off here with the one that I've been talking about for, or at least with Jeremy for quite a bit, and that's going to be the Horror Ghast. You know, Horror Ghast is a 50 mil circle. And it's got Nagash's face on it with a little bit of clouds, a little bit of steam, a little bit of smoke, a little bit of skulls. You know, this one, it actually is kind of funny. The description is just that it's basically a, you know, it is a arcane predator that feasts upon fear. And it is part of the Deathly Wilds of Shyish, taking the appearance of whatever will most terrorize their prey. Often the pitless gaze into Nagash, the great necromancer. So I made a little conversion myself because I did have a spare Nagash head. However, part of me wanted to put anything, you know, maybe as like a little bit of a joke or a gag thing, you know, put something completely different on there. Like whatever the big scary is, you know, at first it was going to be a terror guy's head or, you know, a fire slayer axe or something, because it's like whatever will terrorize people the most, you know, maybe even just a big Slaaneshi symbol, who knows? You know, the horror gas, it's kind of funny. It is very useful, especially in, armies like Legion of Grief or armies that, you know, before we go into the tactical aspect of things, let's talk about what it actually does. It is casting value 6, and you can cast it within 12 inches of the caster. It can then move 9 inches after it's set up, or it can move 12 if you're in the realm of Shyish. And it's real simple here. You just subtract 1 from the bravery characteristic of all units that are within 12. If they're within 6, it's actually subtracting 2 from the bravery instead. So there are a lot of different combos that we can look into here. As a death player, I can tell you right now, yeah, Legion of Grief, not so much Night Haunt, but still with Night Haunt. And then with Flesh Eater Courts, it can be very useful, because you can make things minus, in Legion of Grief, you can easily make something up to minus 10 or 11. But having the ability to utilize Mortis Engines, Banshees, and Crypt Flayers for mortal wounds on the difference of, or if you beat an opponent's bravery, that's really useful. And then for Dread Scythe Herodons, they get enemy units are minus 1 to hit if they're within 3 inches, if their bravery is less than 6. That's just on death side of things. You know, being able to lower bravery to that degree can be pretty useful. Now, John, as someone who primarily plays armies that are not death-based, do you think you might find any sort of combos, given some of the armies you play, that might be helpful with the Horrorghast?
It's funny, Alex. You talked about the Horrorghast with Jeremy, not with me. So my first time ever looking at the rules of the Horrorghast has been right now as you were describing it. So I know exactly as much as the listeners. But that said, that also means that I've never seen it on the tabletop. So from that perspective, it's one of those things that I'm, not terribly worried about, I hate to say. So, like anything, my solution for most problems is to overrun it with bodies.
Understood. Yeah. Away. In fact, I even fought against, Skaven with this in a test list, a couple of weeks ago, and it was real, it actually kind of went nuts because Skaven do have relatively low bravery. And I wasn't able to get the full minus 10 bravery off, but I was able to get, basically multiple units within flayer range. I had allied the Flesh Eater Court mercenaries, so I did have a unit of 6 crypt flayers with me. And I was able to make the entire Skaven front line bravery minus 5. So even though the Crypt Flayers are minus 2 on their 2d6 dice roll against your bravery, and you take the difference of mortal wounds between the dice roll and the bravery of your target, it was a little bit more subdued because of that minus 2, but I still just did a lot of mortal wounds all at once. So.
Yeah, it seems like some of the units, things like Storm Fiends and a lot of those have low bravery. Even the characters actually typically have a bravery of 5. Of course, in Skaven, you do get a double horde bonus, so you get plus 2 per 10. So typically, like your big things, the clan rats and what have you, are pretty immune. And of course, you're not going to help with battle shock with something like the Horrorghast. But like you said, when it comes to doing mortal wounds or attacks that target bravery.
Yeah. And it's only 60 like points. So that's pretty helpful. Okay.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, Alex. I myself, I've been playing with some endless spells pretty much since they came out. And of course, since my Skaven Battletome came out earlier this year, I've been using that one. I've also played a little bit of the Stormcast Meteor I got a funny name for it, but we'll save it on this podcast since we're trying to be family friendly. But so we say the Stormcast Meteor is one that we can dip into your games now and then. And I don't think people realize there are now 43 endless spells in the game. 43 endless spells. Now, if you ask me, that is one too many. 42 would be the perfect number of endless spells, but we'll let them slide with just the one. And so as I go through these, you know, obviously I use, I love the Bell of Doom because it gives me another bubble of immune to bravery. And I used to use the Warp Lightning Vortex, but now it's been nerfed, so it's pretty much useless. It's gone away. But I've been putting my eyes on this one from that we've been talking about, and it's the... I haven't seen it on the table, and I'm not sure why. I think it has to do with range, but it's the Shards of Valigar. That's the one that's the little pyramids that are held together with like some lightning or what have you. And it's a pretty neat spell. It's a casting value of 5, and basically when you cast it, you put one of the shards down, and then you put the second shard 12 inches away from that. And you connect them with a beam, a 1 millimeter line, and any units that it crosses over are going to not only be -1 to hit, they're going to have their move characteristic cut in half. So I thought that was pretty neat little effect there. I think the downside of it is that it only can be placed 6 inches of the caster. And then the second one is 12 inches from that. And unlike normal predatory spells where the person who has the bottom of the priority is going to be the one that gets to move the first of the predatory spells, every turn, both players roll off to see who gets to do the Twilight Translocation and move one of the two shards. And so since you can only cast it 6 inches from your lines, and then there's basically a 50-50 chance that you lose control of it every turn, it's a little bit of a dangerous spell. And I think that's ultimately why we don't end up seeing it. But if you have a fast caster who can run up, dump it in the enemy lines, and then run the heck out of there real quick, then it might be useful. So I don't know. What do you think, Garrett? Have you taken a look at this one, or are there any other of these new endless spells that are catching your eye?
Before I move on to the shards, I did want to say a couple things about the Horrorghast. First, you actually don't move it after you set it up. Unlike many endless spells like the Purple Sun, who have a rule called Swirling Death or something that says after this model is set up, you may move it. The Horrorghast does not have that rule. So you summon it and then you have to wait. It is then a predatory spell from then on. The other thing about the Horrorghast that I think is interesting is in the new FAQ, you can now put things in negative bravery. So with the you can stack a lot of these minus. I think as Alex was alluding to, quick, like the Garrett, minus 10 bravery things. As I mentioned earlier,
I made the Skaven that I was fighting with the Flayers -5 bravery. So no matter what, they were taking, say those 5-man Skaven units in the front line with the -2 from the Crypt Flayers because they weren't within 3 inches. No matter what, that each one of those Skaven units that I was targeting each turn were taking they were taking 3+2d6 essentially, or actually they were taking a minimum of 5.
Yeah, so 5 minimum. Brutal. Yeah. So, but yeah, exactly. And so I think, like for example, you can stack it with the. You can use a bunch of endless spells, actually. There's the Ravarik's Gnashing Jaws at -1 bravery, and then there's the Suffocating Gravetide, which minus bravery. So there's a bunch of fun on the spells if you have enough casters. You can kind of like swarm people, do a bunch of damage with the spells themselves, minus their bravery, and then bring in like Crypt Flayers or Terrorgeist or something and just bravery them to death. So that's the fun thing about the Horrorghast. As far as the shards, I think the main problem with them, John, is that honestly, they're a half-assed shackles.
Oh, well, yeah.
Shackles do the halving of movement, and the shards, as you said, your opponent can take over them and move them for you, and they have such a short range compared to the shackles, and honestly, they only affect people that are being hit by the beam, while the shackles have an area bubble, so it's just they're much harder to use, they're much shorter range, and I think the shackles just do the same job, and these guys are the same points as shackles, too.
Yeah, same points as shackles.
So, I mean, the minus one to hit is
casting value 5, though.
Yeah, the minus one to hit is nice. Shackles are also minus one, or guessing value of five.
Oh, yeah.
So just the shackles just kind of do everything better. Except for the
There's actually quite a bit.
Alex,
now,
you have something to say about this?
I don't think it's going
to
be super useful, especially in an army that I have. But, you know, I did get a hold of the kit, and the two shards, when you take a look at a lot of the images, you know, it looks kind of small. It is important to note that the base size is 4 inches by 2.5. It's an oval. And, yeah, so it is. They are
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's a lot bigger.
That was a
cavalry exactly.
Base.
So
that's
it is
a
bigger
big
base.
Thing.
And you know, you do set the first one up wholly within 6 inches of your caster. So basically, it's going to be right in front of your caster because of the fact that it is 4 inches long. But then you set up the other one, 6 inches, or my bad, you set the other one up wholly within 12 inches of the other. So basically, the distance between the two is going to be not very far. But if you're in the realm of Shyish, you can set it up wholly within 12 of the caster rather than 6. There is the minus one to hit and the half movement characteristic. But because of the fact that they are 4 inches each, you can start screwing with your opponent's deployment. I mean, not deployment, but movement. You can start funneling your opponent with how big these bases are. There's a lot of usefulness here.
Wow, I didn't even think of how you might use them to just block your lines.
Yeah, if you're fighting against an army that's very high cool. with fly keyword, maybe this isn't as useful. But if you have, you know, say 2 pieces of terrain that are hard to move by and you're fighting against armies that don't have fly, you could easily just set these two up and create just a little funnel area, even if you aren't able to really get the minus one or the 1 millimeter line to ensnare units. You're at least, you know, making sure that they go through something. Or if, say, there's 2 buildings right next to each other and you have a Gorfus battalion in your face, you could just set this up and make sure that they can't get past it and go, okay, well, this is it. I hope you get a double turn, you know, or if they don't get the ability to have a double turn, it's like, okay, well, this is where it is now. And you're going to have a harder time now, you know. Garrett, what are your thoughts on the funneling?
So I did want to mention that as far as the short casting range, and I think this happened to me this weekend. So there's the nerf to the Warp Lightning Vortex that says it only could be set up within 13 inches. But Matt Obringer was like, yeah, that doesn't really do anything because you get a Gracier on foot with Skitter Leap, and you Skitter Leap the Gracier up and then just cast it anyways. So you can kind of do the same thing with a lot of these spells that have very short casting range, like the shard. So turn one, you can just Skitter Leap or any sort of like a Bridge of Shadows if you're in the Realm of Shadow, or I don't know many off the top of my head, but if you have any teleport spells or you just pick someone up and place them places, you can just teleport up, summon the shards right in front of your opponent because you can just set up 9 inches away. And then the fun thing with a Skaven is you can actually like set up an aggressive gnaw hole, Skitter Leap up onto your new gnaw hole, summon the thing, and then gnaw hole back to your gnaw hole. So you don't actually even have to sacrifice your
dude.
So there's a lot of fun things you can do with these short casting ranges if you have the tools in your pocket. Just wanted to mention that.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of usefulness there. You know, there is another one. Another spell that I do want to address, and I think for a lot of us, we were all very excited when when it came out. I was looking at you weren't. A lot of people were, so much so that, you know, I was looking at trying to find really cool conversions to just make my own, because I wasn't really, really that excited about the model. And I know that some companies, especially, you know, the ones that have little tiles and movement trays, had started creating some specifically to have this spell implemented with them. And it fizzled out. It, you know, it very much was something that burned out rather than faded away. And that was Laucharn. I'm totally butchered that name. Let's just call him the Soul Seeker. Basically, the remnants of a dead god. Very much the you know, kind of person who guides souls into the underworld. You know, in the River Styx. So it's a guy. It's a skeleton on a boat. And you know, the scoot boat is casting value 6, and if it's successfully cast, you put it within 12 inches of your caster. And when it's set up, it can immediately make a move, and it can move 12 inches or 18 if you're in the realm of Shy-ish. And before you make a move with the model, with the spell, you can pick a friendly unit wholly within 3 inches of that model. You can then remove the unit and place it to one side. After the model is moved, you set that unit up wholly within 3 inches of the model and more than 9 inches away from enemy units. Once that unit has been set up, one model from that unit is immediately slain. So if you do this on, say, a five-man Mournfang unit, that hurts. But if you do this on 30 Hearthguard Berserkers or 30 Grimghast Reapers or something like that, or, you know, or 5 billion Plague Monks that you can fit within 3 inches of it, it gets pretty crazy. And it's on bigger than a normal cavalry base. So that 3 inches can get you quite a bit. Before we talk about the, you know, before we talk about strategies with this one, I got to preface, it burned out a little bit to me because it was FAQ'd. The glorious FAQ did say that once you a unit has moved with the Soul Seeker, though it's not provided in the initial rules or in the card, it does count as their move. So they aren't able to move after getting scooted up the board. That was a really big reason why it became so popular. So it did take the wind out of a lot of people's sails. However, with that being said, John, do you think you might have any use for this?
Sure. Well, first off, let's talk about the name there, Alex. So you figure like the word like laudatory or lauding. So then this is lock on. So you got to always look for the play of words in these GW names.
Okay.
So it's lock on the Soul Seeker. Okay. And that's what he's going to do. He's going to lock on, right, to your soul. Mm. I don't know. Anyways, I thought it was a pretty funny name myself. As far as the unit or the model goes itself, like so many people, I was super excited when I saw this. I play fairly fast armies between my Nurgle, Skaven, and Iden of the Deepkin. I have all fast armies. But the idea that I could, you know, launch a pretty deadly unit an extra 12 inches and then take advantage of their speed to like really get deep into enemy territory had me really excited. I was actually like a stone's throw away from either buying the template, a little MDF template, or making my own. And then it got nerfed. So this is no longer in my eyesight. Now, I think it still has some value. If you have slower units, a 12-inch move still gets you somewhere pretty good. It's not really a 12-inch move, too. I think that, you know, maybe a horde of 40 rats are going to have to swarm all around this thing. But a unit of like 10 guys might be able to start on one end of the boat. And then after the 12-inch move, get set up on the other side of the boat. So they might end up making a 14 or a 16-inch move out of all of it. But then they still would have to make a 9-inch charge. So if you have a unit that has a plus charge mechanic, that can also be nice at that backside. Other than that, I probably am not going to experiment with it now with the nerfs, as just a 12-inch move is something that most of my armies can accomplish. A 12-inch move plus an additional move would have been awesome. So that's kind of where I am with it. Garrett, is this thing still on your radar, or is it kind of washed up on the shore for you as well?
Well, when it first came out, I actually was expecting it to get FAQ'd that you can't move afterwards. I just, the whole time, I was like, this is going to be FAQ'd. This is going to be FAQ'd. At no point did I ever think it was going to work this way, because then it's like, the problem was the FAQ took a little longer than most FAQs do take.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I waited until the big FAQ as opposed to the, I don't know if Forbidden Power got an FAQ until the big FAQ. So I just knew it was always going to be FAQ'd, and I was just like, I'm not sold on this gravy train. Everyone is crazy. Like, this is not going to be a thing, guys. Don't get sold on it. And I was right.
So there's Garrett expecting the old bait and switch from Games
Workshop. Get the old razzle dazzle from the Game Workshop.
But actually, with the new General's Handbook, I have actually considered this, because with the increased points from COGS going up to 80, and guy only being 60, he is a discounted he is a discount from COGS. And I have been playing around with some lists of Grand Host Nagash, where Graveguard become battle line and fielding like 60 Graveguard. This guy becomes a little more attractive because Graveguard have a 4-inch move. So going 12 inches is actually quite nice instead of 4 inches. And then in the realm of death, they go 18 inches and I lose one graveguard. Oh no. So I have actually thought about using this in a grand host list with graveguard as battle line. But outside of that, again, most things are probably better off. Like if you have a 6-inch move, getting a 12-inch move is basically 6 plus a charge plus our 6-inch run. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I have thought about using it with graveguard. So still playing around with that idea. Don't have a current. I need to buy another 30 graveguard before I can even think about that list. And so I'm not looking forward to that, but I do want to try it out.
Well, hey,
just have to now acquire 30 graveguard and that model.
Let's, although let's,
there
let's
might be a bunch of people trying to get rid of the model
that I don't yeah. need. I think you might've actually given them to me or sold them. Oh crap. No, I meant graveguard.
I have 10 graveguard.
You may have even given them to me. I don't remember or pulled them off of you. And then I have 10 more on Spruce. So if you want 20 graveyard, you and I can talk later. Yeah, we wheeling and dealing on this show.
All right.
Hey, you know, I was just noticing this is a predatory spell, so it's possible for you to hop on the boat, ride it into your enemy lines, get your unit wiped out, and then he hops on the boat and rides it back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or better yet, you take a turn moving up to the boat, and then the following turn you lose priority or win it, and the opponent gets control and moves it away from you.
You know, there is just one other spell that was in Forbidden Power, and I think a lot of people just kind of took it to the wayside. I mean, I myself, when I received the kit, thought, this might be good to implement somehow into my, you know, like Renegade Sarastis Knight for 40K or something like that. But the more I look at it, especially with the changes that happened with the Soul Seeker, it's looking kind of tempting. And this is going to be the Soul Scream Bridge, especially in something like a Legion of Grief army. This, like other spells, is a Shyish-based spell, like all the Forbidden Power ones. It is casting value 6. If you cast it, you put the Soul Scream Bridge model wholly within 6 inches of the caster, and then you put the second bridge wholly within 12 of the first. First and foremost, if you're within 1 inch of this, either of the bridges, you are -1 bravery. So, you know, -1 bravery. Then, you know, if you have a death unit or a death army that has multiples minuses to bravery, you can see where I'm going with this one. If you're in the realm of Shyish, instead of setting the second bridge up within 12 inches, you can set it up wholly within 24 inches, which is huge. And what the bridge is primarily used for is kind of like the Soul Seeker, mobility. At the start of your movement phase, friendly units wholly within 6 inches of one Soul Scream Bridge, one of the Soul Scream Bridge models from this endless spell, can travel across the Soul Scream Bridge. If they do so, you remove that unit from the battlefield and set them up wholly within 6 inches of the other Soul Scream Bridge. You still have to be 9 inches away from enemy units, and they can't make a normal move this phase. So they did specify that in this, in this endless spell, unlike the Soul Seeker. I do want to actually give a caveat. When I mentioned that it is -1 bravery, it's not -1 bravery if you're within 1 inch of either of the bridges. It's actually if you're within 6 inches of any of the bridges. So it's actually a little bit of range to that. Now, yeah, so this gives you at least 18 inches of movement, if not more, if you're in the realm of Shyish. John, have you considered or looked into this particular this thing, the Spooky Bridge?
Yeah, you know, the Spooky Bridge is one that has some potential, I think, in my Nurgle army. I think that my Skaven Gnawholes basically do everything I need this to do without.
Well, John, real quick, I'm so sorry to interrupt. It does say friendly models that are within distance of them.
Yeah.
Not.
Oh, and since it's not a predatory spell, that means that the opponent.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I. Garrett is very much a rulesy guy. It does say at the start of your movement phase, friendly units wholly within 6. I don't know if that means friendly for whoever's turn it's in, or.
Yeah, so that's how I interpreted it, that like basically we set the bridge up and in my turn, my friendly models can travel across it rather opposed to, say, picking your enemy models and sending them across the bridge. And then on the backside, I don't see that this gets picked up at the end of the turn or anything. So I would expect my opponent, right, because I don't own the endless spell once it's on the table, can then move his models within and move them back. I mean, what's your take on that, Garrett? Gosh, I hadn't even considered that it might work a different way.
Well, this is a really frustrating thing about endless spells in general and terrain in general as well. This idea of ownership and non-ownership, because like terrain, like all this faction terrain is not owned, but there is the person who brought it, and they sometimes clarify that well. Like one of the big ones that first came up was within the spells happened was the Chronomantic Cogs, because it says the controller may have a wizard within 9 inches, but there's no definition of what the controller is. Is it the current player's turn? Is it, you know, like who is the controller? And I think this is, again, one of those frustrating things where what does friendly mean? Who is friendly to the bridge? Like nobody is friendly to the bridge. I mean, nobody can move. Like honestly, I think I'd have to take a deep dive into the endless spell rules to figure out what friendly means. If you summoned it, does that mean you are, unless it's predatory, does that mean you own the spell? Is it only predatory spells that are owned by neither player? But it is, I think, a frustrating lazy writing that GW has fallen into with this rapid fire of books where they aren't exactly clear on these kind of non-ownership items. So honestly, I don't know how to rule this one.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm glad that if you're a little stumped on this one, then I obviously don't feel bad about not having a clear definition. So again, when I first read it, I simply assumed that either player could take advantage of it. And as I was saying, I see a place for this within my Nurgle army to get a little bit extra there. And that's an army that I'm always looking to add a few extra endless spells. And honestly, I have an excess of casting in that army. So it'd be nice to have
It's 60 points. So it is the
what's
same
the cost as on this thing?
Oh, yeah. It's 80. My apologies.
Yeah, so
my
60
apologies.
Points is reasonable. Yeah.
80.
Oh, yeah, then to heck with it. No, it's not reasonable at all. Well, it's 40 per base, though. I guess that's, you know, best you can expect.
At Triumph GT, Matt Obringer used this with 6 Storm Fiends to basically launch a bunch of Storm Fiends up the board and unload on people. I didn't ever see the list in action, but it was pretty powerful, apparently. I do see this maybe as an alternative to the lock-on Soul Seeker, because I can get, like, in a Grand Host list, you can get, like, a unit of Morghast Harbingers that just, like, go up. Oh, I'm 9 inches away? That's cool. I have a 3d6-inch charge. So getting an 18-inch move instead of a 10-inch move could really get those turn one Harbingers up forward, and then your all of your skeletons can use it as, like, a second wave the coming turns or whatever. That could be a fun strategy in a death list. Again, I'm kind of on a death train right now, and I usually like to think of endless spells with death anyway, since death is a very powerful casting faction.
I think that's a really good point. You know, having it be a solid replacement to the Soul Seeker is definitely something that I think is helpful. You know, when this first came out, I think because the Soul Seeker was so far and away a better unit, a better spell to utilize, that this one kind of went to the wayside. And, you know, this one does have, it is big, you know, it is a 6-inch long base. So it's by no means a small spell, especially with two of them. You know, the -1 can make it very useful for death armies in particular. If we think of a Legion of Grief army, you know, we can try to bring 40 Skellies up the board. We can try to bring Morghast Archai up the board. And if they're defending it too, you know, you're going to be -1 within 6 inches of the Morghast, and you're going to be -1 within 6 inches of the bridge for your enemy units. So, you know, that's just a equal force multiplier, you know, and of course you don't lose a model after you've moved. And that's super, super important. You know, there's going to be, you know, some changes, I'm sure, as we start to add more and more spells. But I do think that with the Battle Tomes, especially the Cities of Sigmar coming out sometime soon, that a static shooting army, you know, a lot of crossbowmen, a lot of riflemen, I think that those are going to be super helpful with the bridge, you know, because then those units that are stagnant, you know, they're stagnant gun lines are suddenly getting a lot of extra range because they're moving up in your face, probably defended by something that can handle themselves in close combat. Garrett, you might have some additional thoughts.
As far as your opponent using it against you, John, the one thing I did realize is that if you have a unit follow up to like use it the next turn, your opponent wouldn't be able to use it because they wouldn't be able to place models outside of 9 of your units that are near it. So you could also just prevent your opponent from using it by having waves constantly go over the bridge.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking if there's a flip flop on the friendly mechanic, then the bravery buff is kind of a double-edged sword too. So I'm not sure that it is a flip-flop spell. I need to read up a little bit more about it too. It is an endless
now,
spell.
That actually is a good thing to note too. Spell, so the minus one bravery is for all units that, you know, it is just a minus one for all units. And it does have a one final specification saying that this ability does not affect death units. So it actually seems completely custom built almost to be used in a death army that's not a Legion of Knight. You know, one that, so that they can have some movement shenanigans in, say, a Legion of Nagash army, but not basically without coming from the gravesite and without being Legion of Knight, maybe a sacrament, grand host, etc.
Well, I mean, I think that's to be expected. You know, we all, of course, know about the boatman on the River Styx, and Lock-On here is actually his less fortunate cousin, who's just doing a little side job out in the mortal realms there.
Yeah. And the bridge is the bridge over the River Styx, I guess. That is has a nice little hole in the middle.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that's well, so that Lock-On can go.
It seems
through.
Like it's a death train. cool. Well, you know, we've been talking about this for quite some time, and you know, before we wrap everything up here, John, Garrett, is there anything you'd like to plug tonight?
Nope, not particularly. Just still mentioning coming up on August 18th, I have an Age of Sigmar tournament. Look on Firehead Productions on Facebook. Come join me for my birthday. It'll be fun.
War Games Con is still coming up. They still have tickets. It's going to be fun. Austin, Texas. And then Nova at the end of the month is going to be a blast. Tickets are sold out, except for the Thursday event. Still has some spots in there. The community out here has been pumping out lots of really nice looking terrain. Chuck Moore up in Pittsburgh has been building a bunch of terrain for it as well. It's going to be a really great tournament. Nova's a great place to come. So you can at least come and check it out. Maybe you'll get a spot. There is, I believe, only 2 people on the wait list. So you could probably get in anyways. But
So Nova and War Games Con. I don't have anything necessarily promote besides T-Shift. By the time this recording comes out, I do believe that 40K might be all booked up. It is going to be a major. It's going to be a GT for Age of Sigmar. Some of your locals, John, they are going to be there. I know that Michael Burke is going to be bringing his Flesh Eater courts, and I saw that Josh Harvey is going to be rolling up with some Deepkin rather than some shooty order. There's going to be a lot of people showing up there. Oh yeah!
I played against that Deepkin list of his too. Pretty nasty. Pretty nasty. I'm not even going to give up the ghost on
but,
it. So
but the
you'll
lists
have to find
are
out
right now.
Get BCP
due to
pay
our
for
good
your
friend Ben
Schmoller, if you want to see.
So, good. Well, I'm glad you were able to give him some practice. Yeah. Perfect. Well, that does wrap it up, everyone, for our this week's episode. You know, be sure, if you do like this episode, be sure to like us on Facebook and Podbean, rate us on Facebook and Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This is going to be Alex, John, and Garrett signing off for the week. Have a great weekend.
Cheers.
Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all the time thing. You don't win once in a while, and you don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time. Winning is a habit.